Okay, welcome back for another episode of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, tonight we decided to talk about gun control and the Second Amendment, a very contentious issue. Virginia, there's been some legislation proposed that has been very controversial, upset a lot of people, and not only does it shed some light on the gun issue itself, but also perhaps the importance of demographics in politics, and we can see how changing demographics can change the politics of a state and even a country. That's a part of it, I think. But the Second Amendment, of course, the Second Amendment to the United States, the Constitution, protects the individual right to keep and bear arms. It was ratified on December 15th, 1791, as part of the Bill of Rights. It reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. It's pretty simple, but it's not that simple. The history of gun control, at least gun legislation in this country, 1934 was the first piece of national gun control legislation that was passed. The National Firearms Act, NFA, was part of FDR's New Deal for crime. It was meant to curtail gangland crimes of that era, such as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. The NFA imposed a tax on the manufacturing, selling, and transporting of firearms listed in the law, among them short-barrel shotguns and rifles, machine guns, firearm mufflers, silencers. Due to the constitutional flaws, the NFA was modified several times. The $200 tax, which was high for the era, was put in place to curtail the transfer of weapons. It's interesting, these things are done under pretext of tax law. This is how they got around the restrictions. They used tax law, interstate commerce, things like that to justify these extensions of federal power. A few years later, 1938, the Federal Firearms Act required gun manufacturers, importers, and dealers to obtain a federal firearms license. It also defined a group of people, including convicted felons, who could not purchase guns. It also mandated that gun sellers keep records. In 1939, there was the United States versus Miller case. There was a ruling regarding the National Firearms Act of 1934. It established that Congress could regulate the interstate selling of short-barrel shotguns. 1968, following the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King, President Lyndon Johnson pushed for the passage of the Gun Control Act of 1968. Considering the intrigue of those assassinations, that's interesting. The Gun Control Act repealed and replaced the Federal Firearms Act, updated Title II of National Firearms Act to fix constitutional issues. The overall bill banned the importing of guns that have no sporting purpose, imposed age restrictions. Gun owners had to be 21 years of age, prohibited felons, the mentally ill, and others from purchasing guns, required that all manufacturer imported guns have a serial number, according to the ATF, imposed stricter licensing and regulation on the firearms industry. In 1986, there's the Firearms Protection Act, which prohibited the National Registry of Dealers' Record and also restricted, or at least limited ATF inspections to one per year unless there was multiple infractions. 1993, the Brady Hand Control Violence Prevention Act was passed, signed by Bill Clinton. Of course, that's named after the Reagan administration spokesman who was wounded in the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan. 1994, the Violent Crime Control Act and Law Enforcement Act. This was the law that put a ban on, restricted so-called assault weapons. Yeah, the assault weapons ban. A temporary prohibition effect from 1994 to 2004. It has since expired. And more recently, 2005, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was signed by President George W. Bush to prevent gun manufacturers from being named in federal and state civil lawsuits for those who are victims of crimes involving guns made by that company. And in 2008, there was the Supreme Court Columbia versus Heller decision that essentially changed a nearly 70-year precedent set by Miller in 1939. The Miller ruling focused on well-regulated militia portion of the Second Amendment. known as the collective rights theory, and referring to the state's rights to defend itself, Heller focused on the individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia. Heller challenged the constitutionality of a 32-year-old handgun ban in Washington, D.C., and found the handgun ban and trigger lock requirement a violation of the Second Amendment. Generally, gun laws in the United States regulated by the states. Gun laws in the United States gun laws in the United States regulate the sale, possession, use of firearm and ammunition. State laws and laws of the District of Columbia and U.S. territories vary considerably and are independent of existing federal firearms laws, although they are sometimes broader and more limited in scope than the federal laws. Gun control got my attention because recently in Virginia, we had some controversy. We had a protest here. Thousands of gun rights activists rallied in the state capital, Richmond, to protest plans by the state Democratic leadership to pass gun control legislation. Lawmakers in the Virginia Senate passed 3 gun control measures last week, sending them to the House for consideration. Several more measures are also under consideration. The 3 bills that moved to the House last week include legislation that required background checks on all firearm sales, limiting gun purchases to 1 30-day period, and allowing the localities to ban guns from public events. All 3 bills were passed along party lines. The Democrats claim these are reasonable public safety measures. The Republicans claim these are laws that will do nothing to combat crime and just bother law-abiding citizens. During the protest, recently in Virginia, more than 100 counties within Virginia, 100 counties, cities, and towns, have declared themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries and vowed to oppose any new unconstitutional restriction on guns. So they're suggesting that should these laws pass, they will not comply with them. And local officials have also signed on to that. So that's interesting, sort of threatening a showdown in the state. During the protest in Richmond, President Trump sent out a tweet. your Second Amendment is under very serious attack in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. That's what happens when you vote for Democrats. They will take your guns away. Republicans will win in Virginia in 2020. Thank you, Dems. So that's kind of a rundown on the history of gun control in the United States, the Second Amendment issue, and this recent legislation in Virginia. Of course, this comes after the Democrats were able to sweep the elections and take control of that they control the legislature and the governor's mansion, and so they decided to propose these laws, and we'll see if they get passed. Very controversial. So it says a lot about politics, and like I said, this might say something about the changing demographics in Virginia. Yeah, Virginia's changed, but particularly in the northern part of the state, it's much more dense and become much more liberal. But we can talk about that. So that's kind of gun control here in Virginia and sort of the history of gun control. What do you have to say about it, Joe?
Wow, what a complicated and emotional issue. Well, first of all, I don't own a gun. Before we started, I was mentioning I live on a little private lane that's off of like a semi-rural road, so it's kind of in the boondocks. There's 9 houses on the road, and I am the only person, I believe, that doesn't have at least 2 ARs. So even though we have no crime, and one of them is a single woman who's basically very ill with cancer, she also has an AR. I feel I don't need an AR because if anyone ever tried to get down here, I mean, the real danger would be being shot in the crossfire, you know? So it isn't something that like emotionally grips me, but it's an important symbolic issue because the idea of the federal government, you're just taking away rights, and people see guns as a way to resist tyranny. You know, this is kind of how I think the proponents of a broad interpretation of the Second Amendment, a literal one too, you know, they would say, look, you know, the government doesn't want us to have guns because the government is threatening, and the fact that we're armed is an actual defense against onset of tyranny. And I would say that this is a great emotion. I would love people to have the concern about the onset of tyranny. I don't see the guns are really going to be very useful. So that's the first thing I would say, is that the idea that, you know, kind of civilian militias with ARs are real deterrent against, you know, mechanized technology in the hands of government, I don't really see that as, you know, fair fight. And I think a better kind of deterrent, it would be individuals inside our own military who would resist orders to, you know, execute civilians and round civilians up, things like that. That's an area I think is more promising as far as resisting tyranny. And unfortunately, that too is under assault because everything is being mechanized and, you know, robotized. And that's really the purpose of technology. So the Second Amendment, I don't really see as a very good, unfortunately, a very good defense against the kind of onset of tyranny that I see in the future. And I actually think that it's sort of like abortion. It's an issue that divides people and ultimately leads to, the way it's being manipulated is it's going to lead to, you know, people demanding more government. I mean, I think that this is kind of how these dialectics are in the press. And I believe the reason that gun control is such a intense issue is because of the media coverage. And I think the media coverage is pretty well designed. You know, it's not accidental, and these aren't legitimate social issues that are being covered. I think it's the other way around. The social issues are, in general, generated. So that's the first thing I would say about, you know, the gun control, is that I don't think it really has a lot of power to resist the technologic tyranny that the government is going to be using over the next few decades to set up the technologic slave state. And I think that it is a way to divide people. It makes us basically more distracted and less unified. So I don't really have a solution, Tim, as to how to deal with the Second Amendment issue. I don't understand how to get to the point where it isn't, you know, kind of creating you know, division among the people who are all facing the same threat. But I would think that you know, we can go into like the history of the Second Amendment perhaps, and as to what it actually was intended for. I mean, perhaps that is a basis, some place to start, to kind of back away from the issue a little bit in terms of the power it has to create division, you know. And I actually, believe it or not, know a little bit about the history of the Second Amendment because of a strange quirk in that it really kind of begins in the Stono River Rebellion in 1739. And I think that's kind of, it's a long story. I don't want to go too far into this, but just in general, that was where there was a slave rebellion. It was on, you know, it was off, just off of the Stono River between St. John's and James and St. James Island, or James Island, which is where my wife's family, the Grimbles, owned all of their property. So this event is etched in the kind of, you know, family stories and unconscious all of her family. And I've actually talked to like her brothers about the episode and their interpretations of it and stuff. And what happened was, it was September 1739. There was one, he was a warrior they had just brought over from Africa, and he organized a bunch of blacks. They broke in, they got some guns, they wanted to head south to Florida because the idea was that if they got there, they could be free. They, you know, it was like a parade. They were chanting liberty, and whenever they came across whites, they would just kill them. And they actually put their heads on pikes. And this is supposed to be a, you know, actual, not just an embellishment. Anyway, what happened was is that the a guy who happened to be a lieutenant governor saw the rebels, heard about it, came, looked, and then he was able to muster the militia. And they got about 100 armed men, and they went back, and they basically shot up the blacks. And it took it took a couple of days to get the whole thing, but that was kind of like the militia as the defender of the people. And so the militia became, from Stoner Rebellion forward, kind of it was synonymous with what was called the slave patrol, which was the term slave patrol militia in the South were completely synonymous. And that's just basically groups of white men who had regular rounds, you know, and they would go and kind of like question any kind of blacks that they saw. So anyway, when the Constitution was created, and the real reason for the Second Amendment was Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which stated that the federal government had the power to raise the national militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And you see, what was worrisome to Patrick Henry and I think George Mason was his name, and these were founding Freemasons, you know, they thought, well, where would that leave the state militias? They didn't. They thought it was so broad that the government would basically be able to have control, kind of control over militias, and they felt that they had to keep control over the militias and the slave controls. Otherwise, they would be risking another 1739 type rebellion. And all of this was going on in the early months of 1791, and then, as if by cue, history sometimes produces this. In August of 79, you had the Haitian Slave Rebellion. Now, this was like the Stoner Rebellion on steroids. The blacks in, you know, San Dominican, it became Haiti later on, but they were still practicing voodoo, the African mystic religion, and so you had a bunch of slaves attending a voodoo ceremony. Tropical storm comes in, lightning and thunder was taken as a good omen, and so they decided they were going to try to go for it and take power. It just went really well for them. They were able to get in and get a whole bunch of guns and powder, and so then. It was just complete bloodbath. They killed well over 4,000 whites. And here's the main thing, is that they would drag the masters and mistresses from the beds, kill the males, rape the women, and then kill the children and put their heads on spikes. This is at least what was recorded. And I have a feeling it's probably accurate, because there was a lot. You got some literature coming from the actual rebellion stuff, and they talk about it. So anyway, this was setting kind of an environment under which the Southern concern about losing control over their militia was not to be, you know, people were a little concerned, and you know, they realized the South under these conditions, as word about the Haitian Rebellion came in, that they were going to be just completely adamant. They were not going to let Article 1, Section 7 go without some clarification. And so you have the Second Amendment, which is, you know, that the militia, they use the term state because they wanted to make sure who would be the controlling element of the militia would be, so that, you know, it was necessary to the, like, an orderly state with capital S. So the rights of, you're not going to take away weapons. So a lot of people think that it was the Second Amendment was included to basically defend against tyranny, but actually it was to maintain the slave state, because all slave states are police states one way or another. And so this was the slave patrol and known as also as the militia were just necessary to keep keep the Southern whites safe. And I just wanted to mention one kind of amusing thing about this. I thought it was amusing, I mean, is that one of the reasons they had to put Article 1, Section 7 in is because the militia in the Revolutionary War was absolutely horrendous at fighting. Washington said they were just unusable because they would not, basically, once they got shot at, they would just take off. They said that they couldn't really shoot. I mean, the idea of like the Minuteman and the militia, because these were the images I had, but when I dug into it, I go, holy cow, the militia are kind of, you know, really not very effective at fighting. And that's one of the reasons why they went for Article 1, Section 7, which incidentally is the basis of the draft, right? That's what creates the power to inscript, young people in the army. So they put that in to make sure that they would be able to control the militia and train them, because they didn't like, they thought, well, we might need to, these guys in the future, and we don't want any more of these state militia because they're not soldiers, you know? So anyway, that was why they did it. And then that was the states, got upset about this, the southern states. And so they ended up, Patrick Henry and what's his name, Mason, right? They stuck the thing in there. There had been, I believe, there was 17 of the 13 colonies. There had been previously 17 sort of Bill of Rights, and only four of them had had in them the rights to bear arms. But I think it was just sort of assumed it wasn't needed to be written down or anything codified because so many people had weapons.
It was their property. And
yeah, it was just their property. The idea that the state would take it away was just insane. But so anyway, that's the Second Amendment. I would hate to see it go down and gun control basically dominate, because that would, I think that would be a chilling moment. And but I think it would be more symbolic than real in terms of resisting tyranny, Tim, because I just don't see the AR as, really going to be that effective against, drone kind of strikes. If they really want to take down the civilian population, and I don't think they would use, troops. I mean, I think the coronavirus is probably more like in line with the technology that we have to worry about. But these are just my opinions. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a military standoff, nor do I want one to be a military standoff. Something like you might have seen like in the so-called American Civil War or something. But if you take an issue of gun ownership and its role in promoting public safety, individual safety, you have a right to defend yourself and defend your home. And so guns are an important part of that. There's nothing more empowering than a woman with a gun. That's why they called guns the great equalizer. And an armed society is generally a polite society. And those societies that have stricter gun control laws have higher crime. Those societies that have more liberal gun control laws, or where people gun ownership is more pervasive, are more peaceful. That's also the reflection of the communities where those gun laws are in place. Urban areas, cities, these things, they have all types of problems with the people who live there. And so it's a different quality of people. So guns aren't a problem in the hands of some people, and they're the problem in the hands of other people. So it's not, it's just a tool. It's a way, it doesn't, guns don't shoot anybody. Someone has to pull the trigger. But when you talk about an issue like gun control, it's interesting if you break it down, who supports it. And really what you have is a lot of, well-to-do, upper middle class or wealthy white progressives who live in nice areas, and they don't feel they need the need. They have the need to protect themselves. So they're, when it comes to things like guns, they're not, not into hunting, and they find guns kind of menacing or dirty, and so they have a certain attitude towards guns and the attitude towards people who like to own guns. So there's a certain, snobbishness towards this, towards those people. And that's what you see in well-to-do areas, but this is particularly in Virginia, like Arlington, McLean, the Northern Virginia area, Falls Church, a lot of liberals who live in very nice areas, and they don't feel threatened. Then there's a role not too far, you go a little south, and then it gets a little more rural, and you have a change in attitudes, where this hunting is more common, People like to, gun ownership was more prevalent, and people like the idea of being able to defend their home should something happen, someone break in or something. So that,
I was just going to ask him, like, are most of the break-ins basically racial? In other words, are they, is like, I know in some areas it's very asymmetric, and like violent crime is basically, associated with black individuals. Is that the
Yes,
case?
blacks and Hispanics. And that's another angle to this issue, where the type of gun violence a lot of people think of, guns and crime, has to do with handguns, and usually the offenders are black or Hispanic. And this is true in Virginia, it's true in many of the cities, Baltimore, New York, and these things. So they're asking, whites to surrender their guns because of a demographic problem, where there's a big problem in black and Hispanic communities, the gun violence and these things. So it's again, they're not addressing the real issue, and at the same time, they're depriving law-abiding citizens a right to be able to defend themselves. The problem isn't law-abiding citizens with guns; it's people who don't follow the law with guns, and they're not going to abide by the gun control laws anyway. And so, from a standpoint of public policy, it's bad policy. It increases crime, and because the criminals feel less threatened, they're less deterred because they know less likely when they enter a home that there's a gun there. If you live in an area where a lot of people own guns, people don't break into homes because they don't get shot. Same thing with concealed carry laws and the open carry, and no one's going to bother anybody to think they might get shot for doing it, for their trouble. But again, you just have a certain ethnocentric, or sorry, just a certain, there's a class issue, an ethnocentric view of these things. And a lot of the progressive whites simply don't like the whites that own guns, and like anything within the so-called white community, there's no unity because there's really no community. Yeah. So another thing is, again, the laws that are being proposed will do nothing to promote public safety. All it will do, it will just make life more difficult for law-abiding citizens who already own guns. So these things are, these laws being passed just to satisfy the moral vanity and ideological presuppositions of liberal whites, and also just to spite, conservative or normal white people in the state of Virginia. It's, again, the whites may remain the majority, but then there's no unity, so there's no real, they don't have a real, they don't have real political power that the politicians feel compelled to at least respect or acknowledge. Another thing in Virginia is, we've had a lot of people pouring in from around the country to go to work for the federal government. Lobbyists, bureaucrats, lawyers—they're all liberal. And Virginia used to be kind of a normal state, even when it was Democratic, it was normal. And so there's a certain, culture in Virginia. Now it's changing because of the density of the northern part that's near the capital. At the same time, there's been, sort of the economy does well here because of the presence of the federal government. There's a lot of demand for labor, so they imported a lot of people from Central America into this country. Brought a lot of illegal immigrants in. A lot of them have been naturalized, so they're importing cheap labor. So it's sort of gone through the change that California's gone through, and some other states with a demographic change. So for a lot of people who talk about the Second Amendment or talk about tax policy, these things, this is where demographics matter. And they don't like
Sure.
to put it in those terms because it sounds racist or racial, but it's true. Demographics ultimately matter in these things. And this, I mean, this has been written about. I've cited this before. Is Adam Winkler, who is a law professor, UCLA law professor, and he wrote an article, "The NRA Were a Fail, It's Inevitable. Just Look at Demographics." And he writes, oops, darn it, I'm sorry. Went by there. I'll edit this part out, but I'll find the article. Yeah, I'm sorry, here we go. He writes, "The National Rifle Association's days of being a political powerhouse may be numbered. Why? The answer is in the numbers. Support for and opposition to gun control is closely associated with several demographic characteristics, including race, level of education," I say indoctrination, but that's and whether one lives in a city. Nearly all are trending forcefully against the NRA. The core of the NRA's support comes from white, rural, and relatively less educated, less indoctrinated voters. This demographic is currently influential in politics, but clearly on the wane, while the decline of white, rural, less educated Americans is generally well known, less often is recognized what this means for gun legislation. Polls show that whites tend to favor gun rights over gun control by a significant margin, 57% to 40%. Yet whites, who comprise 63% of the population today, won't be in the majority for long. Racial minorities are soon to be a majority, and they are the nation's strongest supporters of strict gun laws. An overwhelming majority of African Americans say that gun control is more important than gun rights, 72% to 24%. While the African American population shows no sign of slow growth, other racial minority groups are growing more rapidly and report even greater support for gun control. The fastest growing minority group in America is Latinos. Between 2000 and 2010, the nation's Latino population grew by 43%. Hispanics, which make up 17% of the population today, are expected to grow to 30% of the population in the coming decades. Gun control is extremely popular among Hispanics, with 75% favoring gun safety over gun rights. Asian Americans also represent a growing anti-gun demographic. Although only about 5% of the population today, the Asian American population is predicted to triple over the next few decades. A recent poll of Asian Americans registered voters found that 80% supported stricter gun control laws. Rural Americans tend to oppose gun control, with 63% saying that gun rights are more important than gun control. The country, however, is becoming less rural and more urban. Recent years have witnessed a significant increase in the number of people living in cities, with big metropolitan areas experiencing double-digit growth. Well, okay, so what he's saying is that as the nation becomes less white, there's going to be a change in the public's attitude towards gun control laws, gun rights, and the Second Amendment. But basically what he's saying is that, you know, the Second Amendment, the Bill of Rights, these things, is a white thing. So demographics do matter. It doesn't just pertain to the gun issue, perhaps other issues as well, this politics in general. So the change in the nation's demographics is going to create a qualitative shift in the nation's politics. Well, again, then we get back to that issue is, but we can't, but whites can't address that issue. So what's being told, the nation is changing because they're going to be the minority. So if you want to oppose those changes, you have to stay the majority, but you can't address it in those terms. Although Mr. Winkler here is admitting the argument there.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, the NRA is just it's a buzzword, Tim, to designate, you know, white male, basically. Yeah. Sort of like people will say cultural Marxism is just a way around being, you know, saying something bad about Jewish people. You know, it's a buzzword. You know? But the fact is that, you know, there is this real asymmetry of violence. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the statistics. And I think that, you know, in a great many cases, overwhelming, the people that who are white who have guns would do so with the idea of self-defense, mm-hmm. Or of hunting. Yeah, I mean those are kind of why you would have a weapon. Unfortunately, I think the reason why gun control is popular in African American and Latino communities is because the gangs use the guns for other purposes. Yes. So there's a kind of a, you know, it's hard to get everyone kind of aligned on the same issue because the issues are totally different. You know, like I have talked to gun advocates, like my next door neighbor, like all of them are just enormous. You know, they just love guns and they just want to shoot them all the time. And I think that's fine. But they take the position. You had mentioned that, you know, look at our neighborhood. Everyone knows we're armed to the teeth and there's no crime. I mean, even though, I mean, like the only black person we have in the whole community is Oprah. So, you know, I don't really think she's much of a threat, you know? So, I mean, frankly, I think it's kind of silly, but that's how they feel about it. But they don't have the same perspective of like some like impoverished. I mean, just imagine what it's like in the inner city if you're Latino or black and you're trying to develop like a nuclear family and you look outside and you've got gangs with guns.
Yeah, you know, purchased illegally, though.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that of course, absolutely. But you see, to them, they would see the gun control, which would only restrict and upset the whites who have these guns in their enclaves, and but aren't really going to use them to hurt anybody that isn't actually attacking them.
Yes.
They would be restrained by these laws, whereas the people that they're worried about, they would just laugh at these laws, and there are already tons of laws anyway, you know? In other words, when you have like the Crips and the Bloods have a shootout in downtown LA, they're not using legally obtained weapons and handguns. I mean, it's all, you know, it's everything is illegal. There's even laws against shooting people with them, you know, believe it or not.
And so, this might go back to what we talked about last week about intentional bad policies.
Yes.
Misrule. Governments can promote gun control for the very reason of creating a menacing, dangerous environment, you know, whereas if people, you know, there's a moral issue. If someone has a gun to defend himself and his family, he's making a statement that he's taking responsibility for his family, for his block, for his community. And there's a collective of people who take that responsibility. Not only does the fact that they have a gun make everything safer, but it's a statement they are responsible citizens. Yeah, not depending upon the state. There's no, I mean, what's the difference between you having a gun and the state paying some cop $65,000 a year to carry a gun to show up, you know, 10 minutes after you've been shot?
But I'll just like, I'm just going to use like real time examples. I mean, here on our little lane, every single person has a gun safe, you know, and they have like, if they have handguns, they're under very close controls so that the children can't get at them. There's no chance that there's going to be accidents. People talk about accidental gun shooting or people accidentally shooting their wives. This is preposterous. These people are trained like, they train themselves like military people. You know, they go shooting at least once a month. And so they really know their weapons well, and they know how to use them, and they know how to be safe with them.
Even a child if introduced to a weapon in a
All of their kids
early age can be taught to be responsible with it. Yeah,
Tim, every one of the kids can shoot.
Yeah,
I mean they have all of the kids. There's like eight kids in the land. They're all up. They all can shoot like crazy. So, and they're very, very safe and conscientious. They've been trained since by professional.
Yeah, my kids take part in 4-H programs. They're taught gun safety.
But my point is that there is no amount of gun regulation that is going to make this situation any better. It's as all of the guns are legally registered. You know what I mean? I mean, they're all just, they couldn't be more basically controlled and safe. So there's no reason to go any further.
Well, that's the thing, we're talking to the touchy issue. We're talking about the color of crime, the demographics of crime.
It's not guns
that are the issue. It's the quality of the people. And you're not dealing with the problems in those communities by banning guns.
Right. The problems are not, I mean, the guns don't, see, one thing I will say is that people take the position that, you know, if you have a lot of weapons, everyone knows that everyone is armed, there's going to be less gun violence or less crime. I don't see this. What I see is in areas where everyone has a weapon, like in South Central LA, there's tons of crime and there's hardly any deterrent against gunfights. There was a gunfight in the McDonald's a couple of weeks ago, you know, where four guys are shooting. So I don't think this is much of a deterrent. I think that the idea of the guns being a deterrent it's true in a very broad sense, but only in the sense that the asymmetry of it is
if you have people who are sensible and moral, it works.
Yeah, they won't go into areas that they know the people are armed because they know that it's going to be tough to steal or whatever they want to accomplish there. Whereas inside the inner city, where the gangs are fighting for terse and stuff, the fact that everyone is armed, it doesn't deter anything. Because the quality of the people, this is really what you're looking at, is the net result of the welfare state, of the Great Society program. And the people have been so damaged psychologically and through toxicity and through every other imaginable way that, I mean, basically they have you know, like a national anthem is rap music.
Yeah.
You know, and so the trying to use gun regulations to fix this is as absurd as trying to increase gun regulations on white middle class 4-H club members. I mean, the whole thing is both sides are just, to me, this is just smells of a fake issue that they're trying to whip up emotion just to keep us distracted. And, you know, and of course, they don't want to address any of the real issues on, in the areas where the violence is taking place.
Yeah. The, you call whenever there's these high profile school shootings. We haven't had one for a while, but let's see when there is one. And there's a, you got the immediate call for stricter gun control laws or new legislation, whatever. Then the right wing reaction is, let's arm teachers.
Right.
As a teacher, if there's a shooting in school, you expect your teacher to pull out her six gun and put one in between the eyes of, you know, the shooter. You know, no. Why is it, you know, that, you know, 50 years ago, no one even thought this was even a problem?
Because it wasn't.
So what alchemy occurred, right? I mean, exactly. What happened?
This is the thing, in that instead of looking at the causes, and I think a lot of these mass shootings are fake.
Personally. Yeah, and that's a whole other,
But that's another issue. But just assuming the ones that there are and they're real and there's more frequent now than there were 50 years ago, it's because they've intentionally destroyed culture. And they're getting what they want. They're getting a debased population that some of them are acting out with basically insane behavior. Oh, gosh, we're going to have to increase the power of government.
Gun violence among whites is not a statistical problem.
No.
It is a problem for blacks and Hispanics. So why should – now, this is the problem. You have to treat everyone equally with the law. So why should white people be forced to disarm – and when they're behaving, because in certain areas, in certain demographics, in certain areas, it's out of control. Here's interesting.
This is a perfect example. We were talking about the dysfunction of like bad policy, how it makes people crazy.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to take away weapons from white people that are actually only there to defend the white people against the results of the social policies that has created a violent underclass, right? Yeah. So the idea that this will somehow fix the violent underclass, taking away the defensive weapons of whites, I mean, it produces insanity. It is not a real kind of thought out approach. But the problem, of course, is that there is an asymmetry, a racial asymmetry.
Yes.
And since that cannot be honestly discussed and policies cannot be developed within asymmetry, right? Because we're all just one big clump. We can't have, you know, different policies for the defense of weapons in the white suburbs as opposed to the violent inner cities with gang warfare going on. Since we can't do that, we're not really trying to do a complete solution or any kind of solution at all. We're just trying to basically, the politicians are creating, you know, storylines that they can use to get elected with.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because you need asymmetrical and focused, you know, policies. The problem that people see with the Second Amendment does not lie with the defense of weapons that white people have. The amount of violence that is coming out of that, and there is some, of course. But it's so small, it isn't some kind of national doesn't need national policy to address. But the
in New York City,
this is
the Washington Post had a breakdown of gun violence in New York City. And in short, it was at 95.1% of all murder victims and 95.9% of all shooting victims in New York City are black or Hispanic, and 90.2% of all those arrested for murder and 96.7% of all those arrested for shooting someone are black and Hispanic. If you subtract blacks and Hispanics from the crime statistics, violent crime would drop 91% in New York City.
Yeah. I mean, okay, but you see, could you imagine a policy that attempted to go after that phenomenon? Because the first thing it would do is say, well, the guns in the hands of the whites are actually a good thing because it probably does deter crime, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's self-evident. But now they would say, okay, but here's the crime in the blacks and the Latinos. So what is wrong here? What is wrong with these young males? That, you see, now you have to go back to the social policy, to the great society. These things would get reviewed, and then you would say, well, gee, we've it looks like we've deliberately created a class of violent, uneducated young men of color. It looks like this was intentionally done. But now, you see, instead of this gun issue, you'd have the real issue on the table.
Yeah,
the
this goes back to our talk about the Moynihan Report.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to me, the Moynihan Report was really kind of the thing that most suffered from the lack of the correct decision was the Second Amendment, because it then became this beach ball that got bounced around trying to address the results of the bad social policy. The idea that we can fix the bad social policy that creates 99%, and this is that's actually what I was told the other day by someone who was inside in the poor parts of Detroit, and black guy, and he said, yeah, he says there's no marriages, no, and he says there's no intact families. There are some marriages, but he says it's like 1% of the kids who exist are being raised in nuclear families. It just doesn't happen anymore. Well, that's the problem. You see, this is where the violence is coming from. It's not coming from that we have not enough gun laws in downtown Detroit. I mean, that is not the problem. So since we will not, and the media being controlled will not bring up the real issue, then there isn't going to be any real solution to this. Because the fact is, Tim, and you can see now how the Second Amendment issue, you know, how it's being used. This is, our conversation is making this clearer and clearer. The idea that the gun regulation is somehow going to have any result, beneficial result over the problem is really preposterous, right? Because it can only start moving in a better direction if you address the cause of this.
These are problems, again, yeah, there's problems within these communities, if you even want to call it a community. Behavior.
They're not communities.
They're not, and this is the all-too-common impulsive, you know,
yeah.
Behavior, violent behavior, which is part of the, it's a cultural issue, but then you're blaming the victim, as liberals might say. I mean, what the homicide rate for black population, it's 17.3 per 100,000. And 2.5 per 100,000 for the non-black population, which includes Hispanics and the non-black.
So yeah, it's even lower for whites. If Hispanic out, it'd be almost zero. I mean, this is the thing.
Yeah. Here's another important thing is, it's not a racial. 94% of black murder victims, homicide victims, are killed by blacks.
But you can see what you see then the point of gun law. What they're trying to do is they want to disarm whites with the idea of making them then not have the psychological and real bulwark against the asymmetry of crime. So now what would whites do? Well, they'd look to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, if I don't have my ARs, we're going to need more government stormtroopers here on our block defending us, you know?
So yeah, and that's another thing, is the crime control measures are what? The militarization of the police, these bloated police forces, security forces. You see it when there's an event and all these different parts of the police for law enforcement show up at a crime scene, start bumping into each other, you know don't know what to do, don't want to get on camera, they got their Bearcats and their tanks and their armor, and there's nothing to prevent crime or to promote public safety.
That's the
beat cop 60 years ago wearing a collared shirt and a 38 revolver, you know.
Yeah, but he was walking through an intact culture.
Yeah, and also he lived in that community.
Right. And but so of course, but you see this, like, you get the situation in Richmond. It's very interesting that they had the demonstration in Richmond, because that was where actually the Second Amendment was kind of born. I wondered if someone either knew that or it's just a Freemason humor or something. But Richmond was actually kind of what Article 1, Section 7 was actually generated there. And so now they come back and they have this gun rights rally there where Alex Jones shows up in a tank. You know, I don't know if you caught that, but, you know, whipping up the energy, you know, like, so there's a lot of people trying to fan the flames of, you know, white kind of paranoia about, you know, with the idea of the Second Amendment going away, and they're some of it very legitimate, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you You don't see people coming forward and saying, you know, whites really need to organize themselves to produce the analysis to show the black community what happened to them. You know,
yeah.
We don't see that. We don't see, well, let's get people to real, because the black community is promoting the welfare state now as beneficial, as kind of almost like reparations, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they feel entitled to it. Whites, on the other hand, are seeing this as an example of kind of the asymmetry of righteousness, you know, or how these are people who are socialist parasites, you know.
Yeah.
But these terms and these dialectics are, you know, they don't come out of nowhere. They aren't something that's generated, you know, by the public. These are media propaganda concepts to create the tension. I look at, you know, again, I hate to say it because I know everyone is bored, but I really think the best model for all this is just like the P2 Lodge in Italy. I mean, really what you're seeing with all this crap is just the creation of tensions that keep us on edge, that keep us basically, you know, wanting more government to...
Well, even racial issues. I think a lot of agent provocateurs. I think, I mean, I did an interview a while back about the problems in the South during the Civil Rights era, the late 50s and 60s, and a lot of the violence was actually provoked or fomented by FBI agent provocateurs to create the optics so it would justify federal intervention and smash what remained of Southern independence, and also to prevent the region from the people down there from solving their own problems and creating the conditions, or at least the illusion or the presentation that you needed federal intervention and federal laws. And much of the violence, the church, and people would be very surprised to find out that a lot of the church bombings, the violence, the Klan violence, was provoked by Asian provocateurs, much of the same way we've learned how terrorist acts are often sting operations by the FBI. They can, it's a volatile situation anyway. It's very easy to go down there and you know, add fuel to the fire and create violent situations that otherwise would not have existed. And many of the problems might have been resolved at a local level, and a more peaceful and more, you know, equitable solution than what came about. But we have this, you know, the FBI went down there, and we all know what was that program? COINTELPRO.
Yeah.
How they infiltrated, the Black Panthers and these, and how the federal government paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to black criminal gangs in Chicago. And so it's very easy to see, if you look at the evidence that are occurring down in the South, we have FBI agents and assets provoking a lot of these high-profile bombings and shootings and assassinations that occurred down there. So, it's a very different situation than many people think it is. How it's presented.
Yeah, well said. My position is that I just look at these things as created by the government until proven otherwise. I mean, I just feel that there has been so many demonstrable false flags over the last...
Well, documented Gladio or Northwoods.
Well, yeah, for example.
At what point do you go, okay.
Yeah. I mean, after Gladio and the exposures of the P2 Lodge and the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin, I mean, and of course 9/11, which is just, I think, just almost self-evident, mm-hmm. The collapsing buildings. I mean, at this point, an alert citizen has to basically take the position that this is all just government propaganda. These are all false flags. I mean, I will not believe in a single one of the media stories about a mass violent event until I actually see evidence that I can find is real. You know, it's like the Harvest Las Vegas shooting, you know, that thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually knew, or someone lives near me who said he was shot, and I think he probably, I mean, I don't think he hallucinated that. But I just think that we don't get the real background of the actual event. These things are created. They are created for the purpose of manipulating us to create the value of terror for the government, you know, is so great that's the first way I look at them, Tim, is that that's what it is. And the best response to it is not to go, gee, I need another, anti-terrorist government agent here in my block, but rather just buckle down and do more work to like get more information to the public about how these events are propaganda for the purpose of wrecking our minds, like we talked about last week, so that we won't be able to resist the overall slave state. I mean, really, these events should, because when you do research and you start realizing that, hey, this doesn't make any sense. You know, it's like Sandy Hook, which I don't know if you've ever looked into it, but then the more I looked into it, even though I can't be sure that it wasn't real, it's sure there were so many questions that were unanswered, and weird things that were going on, that I just thought, I can't buy this. I just can't. There has to be a better way of getting information than the one that they use to get that whole stuff to us. So we just have to take the position that it's all fake, that it's propaganda. And so with that attitude, then, you will defend the Second Amendment, I think, with a clearer mind, knowing its limits, knowing its, it isn't really, gun control or unregulated guns situation is not really going to fix anything in the inner city. Getting rid of the gun control laws and letting everyone be armed isn't really going to help anything. Just like restricting guns here in the suburbs isn't going to fix anything.
No.
What needs to be fixed is the production of a polluted culture, violent culture, stupid culture, and really dim citizens who keep putting people back in place that just keep the dialectic going on and on.
Yeah, it's. Again, it's at best a sideshow. At worst, it's a step forward, ultimately to gun confiscation. But again, it is bad policy. It doesn't prevent crime. It actually increases crime, and it goes after you're targeting the very people who aren't even responsible for it. And as you said, it doesn't even address the problems, the causes of these problems anyway, which is, again, a culture that has been debased, degraded, family breakdown, and, just 80%, like I said, 80% illegitimacy.
Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah. You get like the gun advocates will have pictures of like, a break-in. The woman was either able to defend herself or she couldn't because there was a gun regulation in this town.
Yeah.
And she wasn't able to, And so this is these tragic individual episodes that tug on the heartstrings and then, make the dialectic become real vivid. And then on the other side, you have like the mass shooting in a school and the kid has an AR and they go, well, there it is. If we had stricter gun control there, this would never have happened.
Or mental health intervention, preventative.
Right. Yeah.
Mental health intervention.
And then of course in the inner city, it's like, well, we need more regulation because, look, the murder, they could have every imaginable kind of gun regulation in the inner city they can think of, and they still wouldn't reduce the murder by 2%. So, Second Amendment, in my opinion, I think we should fight for it. We don't want any federal government, intrusion into our lives that we just absolutely, can help avoid. But it isn't some kind of panacea. Arming the population isn't going to help. What we need is better analysis of the stuff that makes violent, crazy people that make you want to have a weapon, need a weapon. When I was growing up in in Torrance and in the late 50s, early 60s, there was like a Latino community that wasn't too far. I lived in like a little white suburb kind of place, but there was a Latino community, Hawthorne. I don't know anybody that had a handgun or anything in my area. There was no need for that. There was no violent crime. That was all later after the Great Society created the gangs. But I think if you go there now, the same communities where everyone would be armed, just like they are now in where I live.
Yeah, murder is already illegal. Passing more laws against murder isn't going to solve the problem.
It's not going to solve a thing, right?
No. And so it's, that's, again, it's a, It's not even a band-aid to the problem.
No.
It aggravates it. So, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yeah, I do, Tim. We'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Okay, enjoy the weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.